Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. A whole school approach to literacy with Nicola Lo Celso.
Hello and welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. We have a episode today with a guest from a school who we are building a very good relationship with on the podcast, Willows High School in Cardiff. And Nicola Lo Celso joins us. She is lead practitioner for English and Literacy at Willows. Nicola, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Very good to have you. Perhaps you could start just, we're going to take a deep dive into your role and literacy development on a whole school level in particular, because you're doing some very specific and interesting things at Willow. So we'll get into that. But perhaps before we do, just tell us a little bit about your background and your current role at Willows.
Well, I began my career here in Cardiff in RADA as an English and drama teacher, and then moved to the Vale as head of English. Then I spent 7 years in New York City, first as an English teacher, then as the literacy coordinator, and then as assistant principal for teaching and learning, with literacy at the forefront. Then when I returned, I worked with Consortium and worked for 4 years on the RAISE poverty grant, and also worked with the English department there, and then moved on to the National Support Programme and did a lot of thinking around literacy, supporting schools, and then moved back into teaching at Willows.
Thank you very much. And for those who either didn't listen to our episode with your colleague Kelly Bubbins last season, perhaps you could just paint us a picture of, you know, the community that Willow serves, the sort of context that you're working within, and maybe just give us a flavour of maybe some of the challenges that young people who come into school at Willows might face when it comes to literacy.
I think we're the second most challenged school in Wales in terms of our catchment and in terms of the poverty index. We have significant numbers of children coming in with low reading ages, significantly below their chronological reading age. We're around 60% free school meals. We have a substantial percentage of English language learners. Quite high ALN numbers. But like many schools, but particularly schools in our circumstances, we also have an awful lot of children who are on roll, but who don't necessarily attend full time. So it's a highly challenging circumstance when it comes to trying to drive up standards and to make sure that we offer the pupils who are there in front of us the best possible, most challenging curriculum that suits them.
Now, we know from our episode with Kelly, where we were sort of looking at your whole school behaviour policy and how that sort of affects the culture of the school in lots of positive ways. And we know that a big part of that change was senior leadership going out, looking to see what was going on in other schools and coming back and finding the sort of the Willows way. And I wondered, was literacy part of that discussion? Were there any fundamental changes that you could see from your perspective in your role as lead practitioner for English and literacy that came with that culture change that were sort of driving up literacy standards?
I mean, ironically, and I know that there will be many practitioners out there who are horrified by our booklet approach. The introduction of the booklet approach allowed me as literacy practitioner to actually look at the literacy within all subjects quite closely and to work with other departments to make sure that the literacy within those booklets was at the standard that we wanted it to be. So on our journey, one of the things that we've looked at is making sure that the text within the booklets isn't differentiated down, that we still include appropriately challenging text, and behind that then I've done a lot of training on things like shared reading strategies, on boxing up, on annotating, and particularly on oracy around the literacy within the booklet. So that the change for us was actually a really good one in terms of literacy. I think it's been immensely helpful in getting consistency and also getting a common language with staff where there are no real grey areas. It's really quite crystal clear what we're all working towards.
This is making me think about an episode we did at the start of last year's podcast season, which was when that news story came out about primary, sort of early years reading, and there was a real concern about the fact that what was in the curriculum was perhaps not being sufficiently directional. You know, there were schools doing all sorts of different things out of, you know, perfectly good intentions, but that there was a suggestion that perhaps there were certain things that needed to be said in the document saying, no, you ought to be doing this and not that. So in that sort of context of a framework which perhaps doesn't prescribe a huge amount, I guess you had to go out and find a lot of stuff for yourself. Did you do a lot of finding out and research? What sort of, you know, if somebody else is out there thinking, oh, I'm the literacy coordinator, you know, can I have some goodies? What would you signpost people towards to sort of fill those gaps, really?
Well, it's interesting you say that, but obviously having been, you know, teaching for 37 years, it's, I've picked up a lot along the way. And one of the things that I found interesting is a lot of schools have now adopted the walkthroughs books, the Sherrington and Cavaglioli, and I mapped all of our practice against the research within the book. Mm-hmm. And in actual fact, if schools are using a text like that as their guiding principle, you can't really go far wrong because, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the training I received an awful lot of principals literacy training in New York City with gurus like Kylene Beers. And all of that, the messages are still intrinsically the same. You know, Willingham, it's all there. It's all in there. And so all of our practice, whether it's what's actually in the booklets or whether it's how we map literacy and how we integrate assessment for learning, all of that is already highly researched and quite neatly packaged. If schools, I know many schools are actually using it, but if they're not, I would definitely recommend using it because it is so neatly packaged and ties so many threads from so many experts together.
Before we get into the nitty gritty of, you know, what sort of strategies to support literacy, particularly reading, are sort of baked into the booklets, I hope you don't mind me saying, but before we started recording, you mentioned that from the outside looking in, on face value, people might balk at the idea of booklets for all subject disciplines. Why do you think people have that sort of reaction? And what would you say to sort of counter any concerns that they might have around the use of booklets on a whole school level?
I think the reason that people react that way is because they think that it will stifle individual creativity. However, I don't really understand why, if I'm honest, because, I mean, I could understand that if it were a top-down approach, but we produce our booklets together. We quality shore the questioning together. We look at the question, we critique the questioning. After we've taught it, we say, this didn't work. We look at gathering texts together. We make decisions about the texts that we include together. If someone finds a brilliant film clip or an article, it's put into the shared resource and we, you know, the booklets evolve as we go along. So there's a high degree of creativity in the way that we work as a department. So even if, and obviously we're a small school, so we have departments that are essentially the head of department making those creative decisions anyway. But the argument that I will give for saying this is a better way to do it is that it ensures that you don't have an off day because the thinking has been done, the critiquing, the ensuring that there's high-level questioning in there, the ensuring that it's balanced, the mapping of the nature of the writing tasks that we do, the building in of the oracy that we do is all there. Mm-hmm. Teachers certainly do, bring something that they found last night that they want it, and they put that up and they share that with the children, and that's absolutely fine. But at the end of each term, all of us have provided the same diet to the children. They've had a consistent approach, because the approach within the booklets is the same. That doesn't mean that they haven't had the quirks and the humour and the character of their teacher throughout that. But we can ensure that we have got good coverage. And in my travels to lots of schools where there's been a great deal of teacher autonomy, one of the things that I found was that the diet then becomes different. And also that the quite often the forms of writing, for example, are repetitive, that there's not as much of a spread, there's not as much, you know, the coverage is uneven. And that's not fair on children. It shouldn't be down to which class you're in, which teacher you have, as to what you learn. I think it, you know, it's something that should be discussed at a bigger level and agreed on.
I'm fascinated by the point that you made that this is not a top-down approach. So I wonder if we could sort of pull back the curtain here and sort of give us an insight into how you work with a member of department or a departmental team if they're starting from scratch, if they're coming in, they have no booklets. You know, I'm a drama practitioner. You know, imagine you're sat down working with me. Like, where do you start? Because it seems that the booklet in your context is almost at the sort of nexus of curriculum design. So how do you start with that sort of member of staff, and what kind of fundamental aspects of literacy development get baked into that booklet through that process?
Well, I'm not going to lie. We start with GCSE.
Okay.
We're not an A-level school. Otherwise, I'd be thinking about A-level as well. I mean, obviously, we our practitioners do think about it. But ultimately, our responsibility is to help our children be successful at GCSE so that they can go on to do whatever they want. So we look at the skills and the knowledge that's embedded in GCSE, whatever subject it is, and then we work backwards and look at what that means for Key Stage 3 and what we need the children to learn how to do to be able to be successful and hit the ground running in year 10. Mm-hmm. So then alongside that, because that obviously there's a greater degree of freedom in Key Stage 3, we said, well, what works really well? What do you think is brilliant? What gets the best results with the students? We'll take that content and then we will build on it and look at the skills and look at how we can come up with a model that's going to achieve two things. It's going to be motivational and engaging, and it's also going to provide them with the skills that they need when they get to year 10.
Thinking about reading, and I suppose we're still floating around in the philosophical realm a little bit here when I'm asking this. I'm thinking back to when we did the episode about phonics and things in the early years, and I was sort of signposted towards this debate, and I never really got the opportunity to kind of dig into it. So I'm just going to sort of ask you where you stand on this. And I know the phonics thing is generally a sort of primary early years thing, I suppose, is it, rather than secondary?
It is, but we still need to teach phonics to those who don't have a grasp on phonics.
Yeah, and there was this debate I was sort of pointed towards where you had people who were saying, right, the science is saying you've got to do a load of this stuff and then kids are going to learn to read. So, you know, why wouldn't you just do tons and tons of that? And then there's another side where people will say, oh, you're killing the pleasure of reading. You know, kids are not reading for pleasure anymore. And maybe it's because, you know, they associate it with, you know, banging away at phonics for hours. And then, of course, the other side of that then is people saying, well, there's no pleasure in reading for pleasure if you can't read. And round you go. No, you know, so how do you sort of find a balance between making sure things are structured and making sure that, you know, your ultimate aspiration, I guess, as an English teacher, your pupils are choosing to go and find a book and read it for fun?
Well, let's go back to the primary idea and phonics. They need consistent phonic instruction to be able to learn to decode and to read at an early age. Come to around year 5, evidence suggests that that's when that divide between the haves and have-nots begins to really take hold. And that's because they're no longer tested on decoding and they're tested on understanding and comprehension. By the time they get to us, we have And, you know, our primary schools are amazing and work miracles to try to get them to the reading ages that they do because of obviously what they're coming in with. But by the time they get to us, we have an enormous gap. And that gap is obviously cultural, you know, as much as it is to do with anything else. And we then have to straddle two ideologies. So we have to try to work out if phonics is the issue and if decoding is the issue, or whether it's actually now fallen into the realms of comprehension, which is to do with two things. It is to do with rehearsing all the skills that we need to rehearse to become stronger and more robust readers. But it's also massively to do with the knowledge gap. And it's to do with the word gap. And so what we try to do, and we've done something quite radical, and this is the first school that I've really trialed this with, is we've gone back to almost a primary model within English, and we now have what we call readers' workshops. That's something I took from my time in New York. So we've creamed back the curriculum so that we have once a week a readers' workshop. During that readers' workshop, all English teachers actually conference with targeted children in the class. So we listen to them read and we try to identify what they're having issues with, and then we set goals for them to work on for the next time. It's possible that from that we will see a greater issue that we need to then move to pass over to intervention, but we largely have identified them for intervention prior to that. We have a group of children who are receiving intervention, and then we have to take the next tier of children because we can't, all children can't have intervention, and we have massive numbers of children who are reading below their chronological age. Mm-hmm. So we take the next tier, and then through that conferencing, we try to boost them. While we are conferencing, and this is a huge part of what you were alluding to there, the librarian, our new librarian, I'm going to give a shout out to Olivia and to our previous librarian, Ivana. Our librarian Olivia comes to class, picks up the students in small groups, takes them to the library, and they change their reading book. And we do that on a fortnightly basis. And they may, if they finish their book, they might sit down and do a quiz. We have an accelerated reader. We've also got the new Oliver system where they can do quizzes on the different books, where they get a great sense of achievement, which is highly motivational. And it, because all of our books are ZPD'd, because the children are star tested, they are encouraged by the librarian, because she's there with just a small group, to choose a book that is right for them. So we are putting a massive, massive emphasis on reading for pleasure, because all of the research says that motivation is a massive, has a massive impact on reading success. And so we're really trying to motivate them in that way. They read for utility, obviously, throughout the curriculum, but without that reading for pleasure, what we're not furnishing them with is the vocabulary, the semantics, everything that goes into, obviously, reading a good quality book. So we're doing both. We will identify if there is an issue with phonics. We identify if there are issues with spelling, orthology, you know, actually being able to see the word and understand the word, which obviously we have a lot of issues with our English as an additional language students. We flag whoever we need to flag up for intervention, and then we work in the classroom with those students who are slightly above intervention stage but still need more support to become more robust learners.
Going back to the booklets now, I'm just thinking of practitioners out there who school may not adopt that approach. However, as you mentioned, sort of built into the booklets are
literacy strategies, strategies to develop reading, to scaffold and support writing. Oracy is baked into that. So could you give us a, sort of a, an indication of what kinds of approaches are baked into the booklets that actually a teacher in a school that's not using a booklet would be well, you know, would do well to embed within their practice day to day in secondary?
Well, we start with recap questions for obvious reasons, to keep spiralling the knowledge and to try to fill that knowledge gap. But the recap questions aren't necessarily the springboard for the lesson to come. They might be related or they might be something we're keeping on the boil. So then we always put in an activating schema task. And in a school like ours, that's actually absolutely fundamental, because if you're talking about activating schema, it also raises the question, are the schema there in the first place? So through activating schema and then discussing it as a whole class, we're actually providing schema for some of those students. So that's hugely important. Following that, before the text, we pull out the academic vocabulary or subject-specific terms, both, you know, if necessary. And we give them the word class and we give them a definition. And we do something called I say, you say, dwi'n dweud, hi'n dweud, which I'm sure lots of schools are using. And so we orally rehearse the vocabulary before we start the text. In English, we also then write up, depends how many words we think are going to be really useful to them. We write those up in academic vocabulary lists in their English book. So we maintain running lists of vocabulary that we then quiz them on. So then what we've done is highlighted the vocabulary in the text that follows, so that we're trying to make those connections. So while we're doing the academic, the I say, you say, we also obviously discuss the words in various contexts to try to go for that deep meaning rather than shallow understanding of the word. We then reinforce it with the text. Then after the text, we further reinforce key vocabulary in addition to key themes and ideas with a series of what we've decided to call smart questioning. Essentially a combination of multiple choice, matching, questions that do not require a great deal of writing. So we're not hampering the students' understanding by forcing them to write, which for some of them is quite difficult, but are quite quick fix questions that ask them also to make inferences about the text, to delve deeper into language, to understand literary and linguistic terms. And those questions are deliberately designed to build to the extended writing task. So the extended writing task might, across the curriculum, could be explain, describe, it could be synthesize, compare. With us, we also have mini writes where we ask them to empathize, etc. So what we do is make sure that through the combination of the oral rehearsal, through the smart questioning, where we actually go over the smart questioning before then they do the task. So we'll have a combination of hands up, we'll have cold calling, etc. And so we'll establish understanding and the right answers before they do the task. So hopefully then that will furnish them with the understanding and the vocabulary that they need to complete the task. Obviously, in practical lessons, it can be slightly different.
Yeah.
I have a question about oracy, and I know I'm at risk here because this is Emma's favourite topic, and she, luckily the table is large and she can't kick me for stealing what was probably her question. And you mentioned oracy in passing earlier on, and I was thinking about it just then and how Kelly spoke really articulately in her episode about Willows, about the fact that one of the big things you need to do is to get pupils over that lack of confidence that comes from feeling like they have not had some of the opportunities that some of their peers may have, and that getting them to a place where they can mix it with people who've perhaps had a few more breaks in life. And I was thinking, gosh, yes, oracy's sort of a big, big part of that. Emma and I have talked at length in loads of episodes about the fact that lots of subjects are very happy with the idea of oracy. They love the idea of oracy. it's not always a given that it's being done to a high quality. And of course, it's so ephemeral that it can be really hard to get a handle on it as a literacy coordinator, because you can't capture it in quite the same way because it's there and it's gone. So how do you get a handle on oracy and make sure that that's as good as the other parts of literacy? Because it sounds like you have got a handle on it from something you said earlier on.
Well, within English, we have highly structured, regular oracy slots throughout the curriculum in Key Stage 3. So we rehearse them in group discussion skills, and they do it regularly. And we actually rehearse them in presentation skills as well. And we combine it with our digital competence tasks where they're filming each other, et cetera, et cetera. Across the curriculum, what we've done is mapped literacy across the curriculum. And so I've mapped the oracy in the higher oracy subjects. So, for instance, drama, PE. There's an awful lot of oracy that is fundamental to their success within the subject. And what we use in our school, which is something I also brought from New York and introduced here actually with the support program, was the idea of a success criteria rubric. So within the rubric, the standard of oracy, the expected standard of oracy, the language of that is written into the rubric. So it enables staff and students alike to understand what they need to achieve to be successful orally. Mm-hmm. And within those rubrics then, there are nuances within the subjects. So, for example, if it were French, there will be an emphasis on the grammatical items that they want them to practice. Mm-hmm. If it's in PE, for instance, they do coaching. So it will be the language of coaching that they want them to use. If it's in drama, whether it's actually, it could be a monologue. Then you bring in another element, which is, to do with empathy, etc. So we work as a staff to make sure that when we think about the large oracy pieces, we're doing it in a highly structured way, and that we're training students to understand how to move up that rubric and which aspect of their oracy that they're not quite achieving, and they might, what are their next steps so that they can become better at oracy. Now, smaller pieces of oracy within the curriculum, we've sort of structured in terms of we have a silent solo followed by a turn and talk, mm-hmm. which allows them to think about their ideas before they then turn to a partner and discuss it. And then we go to a whole class discussion. We have just a minute, which is quite good fun for them and gives them the opportunity to share their knowledge, but also have a bit of fun while they're doing it, and to take it in turns. But it all works together to try to give them the confidence to speak out loud and to be able to feel comfortable around their peers. Now, obviously, it doesn't work for every student. We still have very shy students who find it challenging. But I think that we have put the opportunities in there and the rigor in there that's needed to consciously try to develop oracy alongside things like I say, you say, where we get them, and also the chanting that we do to try to get them used to hearing the sounds of their own voices.
A question that is probably asked of you many times in an academic year is, how do you know it's working? And what evidence have you got to suggest that it is? And I suppose the booklets have been in for how long? How long now?
Well, they were pre-COVID, and obviously we had a glip. Yeah. But we're really embedded now. Yeah. We're really embedded. So, yes, it's been quite a journey. I think it was about 2019. gosh, time flies, but we're well on that journey, and they're definitely embedded now.
And I'm really interested, because obviously there's the outcomes in the different strands of literacy that I'm sure you're regularly gathering quantitative and qualitative data, progression, all of that. I'm interested to know, you know, how have secondary practitioners at Willows felt this has impacted outcomes in the subject more broadly? Are they seeing, you know, that this correlation between a much more rigorous focus on literacy and the outcomes that pupils are managing to achieve at GCSE or just as they progress through school?
Well, I think we measure success in many ways. Mm-hmm. GCSEs, in terms of our GCSE results, we very much hold our own within our family. And, you know, you have to think of it in terms of families, obviously, because of the nature of the school. And we're quite happy with the results that we're having in that respect. Obviously, we constantly want to achieve more. And some of the tools that we use for that are, obviously, we have standard reading testing. So our reading, my second in department, Jess, we'll give her a shout out, is working really hard at the moment with our RADI pupils and seeing success with increased reading ages and seeing the month-on-month improvement, which is really good. We also do qualitative measurements where we have pupil voice. And ask them about the curriculum and how, and about their self-efficacy. And I think that's actually a huge part of it. So in terms of measuring success in a school where our baseline is very low, you have to look at you'll have to look at the breadth of things. So if you, for instance, look at the number of students who go on to college and then higher education. We have students who really exceed, and it's wonderful to see them exceeding what we actually even imagined they would do before they left us. And I think that I feel very proud of the fact that we've given them the environment in which they can flourish and succeed. And in addition to that, you know, when you obviously, we have our GCSE results are impacted by the number of students who are on roll who don't turn up, or the number of students who are EAL students who've just arrived in year 10. And so actually, I don't think it gives the full picture. I have pupils now in year 11 who've just left us who I know are going to go on to do much greater things because of the grounding that we've given them. They might not quite make where they should be now because their English language isn't there yet. So we've got a really mixed picture in terms of how you measure success. Mm. And I think that our constant goal, obviously, is to try to, more than anything, provide them with the literacy to be successful across the board and in all of those subjects, which is why we're a literacy-focused school.
You're making me think now about those outcomes, those maybe sort of unintended consequences of focusing on things like literacy and the impact that can have on a broader scale in a school. I'm thinking of a workshop that I once attended with a bit of a guru in the world of Shakespeare in action, Cicely Berry, who said that where language fails, violence prevails. And it's, you know, if you don't have the words to communicate and express, you know, how you feel to one another, then it can have a real impact on societal behaviour, you know, behaviour within a school. So I wondered, you know, are you seeing a link between the efforts that you've put in to improve literacy and the efforts that you're putting in around school culture and behavioural culture amongst your pupils?
Massively. There's no question that it has an impact. We've got a calm environment. If a child is struggling for any reason and is not coping within the classroom, then the child is removed somewhere where they can be quiet and they can find it easier to concentrate. And we can get on and teach the rest of the class. I think also coming back to your point about oracy, the children are more confident at speaking because we greet them in the hallway and we speak to them. We speak to them all the time. I have to give a shout out to my husband now, who's leads on character and behaviour, and stands and shakes the hand and says good morning to every child coming into the school in the morning, stands in the hallway all the time. We all stand in the hallway. Bore da, prin han da, ting yon. So that the building character, also the other main component is positive framing. So if a child is approached for behaving inappropriately, they will be approached in a positive way. And so we do, I strongly feel that our children, and I get a lot of feedback for this, understand that we are working for them and not against them. And when you come back to motivation to learn, that's huge. So we do have classrooms where the majority of children are at least in the right frame of mind to be able to learn, which is ultimately what it's about, isn't it? Is if they're upset, if they're angry, something's bothered them. We have a massive welfare team, and we put an awful lot of effort into character and behaviour to ensure that they're in the right, that they get the best possible opportunity to learn when they're in the classroom.
I was interested in a point that you made quite early on in this podcast about keeping the challenge high when it comes to reading. But also offering the support, such as some of the strategies that you mentioned around sort of vocabulary building, et cetera, to make sure that they can really get into that text. But if you're a practitioner in a classroom that's maybe not in a big department and doesn't really know where to start about how do I select suitably challenging and well-pitched extracts for reading within, you know, if I'm using it in a booklet or as a resource in the classroom, have you got any sort of advice or tips that might help guide practitioners to make sure that they keep that challenge in reading high?
Well, I think one of the things I will say, although I think that this might be controversial, is that obviously there's a lot of advice. There are a lot of people. We have support from the consortium. We have a lot of experts out there who are designed to help you with that and not to be afraid to pick up the phone or shoot an email off to get support. Also, we have a network of experienced teachers who have gone through the same process and are using things with a high level of success. And so reaching out to other schools as well, other schools perhaps in similar circumstances. We're all in families of schools. I'm going to the South Wales Partnership meeting next week. And not feeling like you're on your own, and that whole, you know, the ancient reinventing the wheel metaphor. It's the truth of the matter is that there's an awful lot of experience and quality material out there that people are more than happy to share, and that you can make your own. With regard to reading age, etc., obviously work with your school librarian, and if you don't have one, there's plenty, an awful lot of online help about reading ages of particular texts that have been smogged effectively, and that will tell you their suitability. Most newspapers and most online news is of a reading age. I will stress a reading age in terms of suitability. But I would say if you're unsure, ask someone who's been doing it for a while.
And I suppose that leads me to my final question. Tom might have another final question, I'm not sure. But
I'm mulling whether to ask it.
Okay, well, whilst you mull, I'm thinking of the aspiring literacy coordinators out there, or those who have a responsibility in a school for literacy. And I wondered if to them you might be able to give some, I know you've got a wealth of experience that's taken you to this point, but you know, if there's someone out there thinking, gosh, I can see myself sort of really excelling, you know, and really getting a lot from that role, what would you advise them to do, to look at, to read, to who would they speak to really put them in a good position to go for that kind of role?
I think the main advantage when it comes to being a literacy coordinator is to actually know and understand the nature of the curriculum. And one of the things that you need to do, because I really believe that you need to map literacy across the curriculum, you need to map the big pieces. We map extended writing, and within that, obviously, there's a reading component across the curriculum. We map oracy. I think that you need to be familiar with the curriculum that you were thinking of leading. So the first port of call has got to be to understand the nature of the literacy in other subjects. I mean, that's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Because it's very difficult to advise people on what they should do if you don't understand the nature of that literacy. So understanding the nature of the long answer questions in science at GCSE, the nature of, you know, in history and RE and etc., that informs you in a way that will give you confidence. I mean, other than that, obviously, there's a wealth of reading out there. I mentioned Willingham earlier and really understanding reading. But then going back to walkthroughs, there's an awful lot in there on literacy. Things like read alouds, which, you know, I was introduced to with Kyleen Beers, and that's all coming through now with Rose and Shine and, you know, the Marge model. All of those things that are in those walkthroughs are a really good place. So if you don't already have that, I would say you could use that as a springboard in terms of your research.
Thinking about literacy, which is so fundamental to pupils learning really across the whole curriculum, thinking about the fact that actually the reforms that we've been reforming away here in Wales for what now, you know, 12, 13 years, a lot of that was kick-started by concerns about literacy, you know, PISA results and what have you. I'm just really struck by the fact that now we're just reaching a point where one or two people have started to say some quite pokey things about the way that literacy has been framed in the curriculum. We had a guest on a couple of years ago who said that not incorporating the science of reading in the curriculum for Wales was the biggest thing wrong with it. We've had another guest, Lucy Crehan, who said she's really worried about equity. You know, that with such freedom comes potentially inequity. And obviously, if you're working in Willows, which, as you and Kelly have both said, you know, you're laser focused on closing that gap between the haves and the have-nots. They're obviously lucky to have you with all your experience and all your globe trotting. You know, you've been able to pull all kinds of things in. We know we're in a bit of a recruitment crisis, you know, so I guess not every school has got a Nicola Lo-Celso sitting in there drawing on all this stuff. I just find myself wondering, does everything have to be put together in the way that you've done? You've done all these rubrics, all this work. Is the stuff that should be in there and non-negotiable that's not at the moment?
I mean, I didn't really understand why there wasn't just a Welsh phonics programme. I'll be honest, it just makes things simpler, you know. All teachers are working incredibly hard, and going back to it again, reinventing the wheel time and again.
Yeah.
When in actual fact, the science is there, we know that we need it. That might have made things easier for schools, simpler for schools. You know, there are huge cost implications also with buying various phonics programmes and then changing them, etc. So I do think that there might be an issue with equity, with too much freedom, and with the best will in the world, because everything that our primary schools teach children is wonderful. It's not necessarily the same. And therefore, it's not necessarily going to be able to furnish them when they come to secondary school to be able to be GCSE ready. So I would agree that perhaps there could be a slightly tighter remit that would help primary practitioners in particular to be able to navigate what they're meant to do, because they're meant to do so much, you know, work miracles sometimes. I think it's easier as a secondary practitioner, and perhaps because I'm old, I haven't found the curriculum change intimidating because our goal hasn't changed. I know what we need to get them to, and that's what we work towards, you know. We're able to encompass all of the guiding principles, you know, citizenship and healthy you know, healthy individual, we're able to incorporate all of the curriculum into what we do with ease. But I do think perhaps for primary schools, there's been a great deal of pressure to come up with creative new things that, and maybe not necessarily, I don't think they will throw the baby out with the bathwater, but there's an awful lot of pressure on them, and it could have been perhaps potentially a bit easier.
Nicola, thank you very much. We've ranged far and wide in that conversation around literacy, because I guess it is one of those aspects of education that does take you into a lot of different places and topics. So thank you very much for giving us the benefits of your wisdom and experience on that front. I know that you've done your homework for our short slots, so I can quite calmly ask you.
I was a bit lazy because I was reading it anyway.
It's not lazy at all. It's a genuine authentic response. So tell us there's something interesting that you've brought to the podcast today.
So my something interesting is Autocracy Inc. by Anne Applebaum. I went to the Hay Festival and heard her speak over half term, and it inspired me to buy and read her book, because I am deeply worried about democracy at the moment. And it's something that I regularly bring into conversations with the children, because I do think that for all sorts of reasons, there's a degree of complacency about what it means to be part of a democracy, perhaps a degree of complacency about voting. And about what's my part in this, and does it really matter, and all of those things. And I think it's also nice because it's fired up some of my Year 11s to write in their individual researched presentations about our good friend Donald Trump and about the threat to democracy that's, you know, inherent in these autocratic tendencies. So, yes, Autocracy Inc. by Anne Applebaum. It's fascinating. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner. She's a genius. And it's powerful stuff that I think children also need to know about.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I was going to pick up on that. I'm off-piste now. there's a certain amount going around, isn't there, that the younger generation are almost kind of, there's an increasing number of them saying it's better to have a strong leader than a sort of democratic process. And also there's all this sort of narrative that Trump sort of surfed the wave to his second coming, as it were, off the back of people who are from less advantaged backgrounds who just sort of went, politics isn't working for me, I'm just going to roll the dice. What are your pupils who potentially come from a background, maybe, who might fit that bill? What do they make of it when you speak to them about that stuff? Are they actually all pro-democracy?
I get quizzical looks, but, you know, we teach Animal Farm in Year 9. So we sort of lay the foundations of thinking about these things well within, even from Year 7. And it's really reassuring to hear them actually saying what you want to hear and actually saying, well, that's not right. That's not right, miss, is it? And coming to Year 11 and then writing about the threat to democracy, you know, in the current climate and things like that. So I'm sure, obviously, there are children who, for various reasons, question it. But for the most part, I find that opening up discussions about things like this, teaching them texts that make them question their freedoms, is very powerful and hopefully puts them in the right frame of mind to carry that on. So I'm going to be, I think it's Anne Applebaum who said, being a pessimist is irresponsible. So I'm going to be an optimist on this and say we're going to keep fighting the good fight and just trying to get them as informed as humanly possible through our curriculum to make sure that they can make, you know, properly informed judgments, not just web-surfed judgments. Yeah.
So we have one final short slot, which is something to try, although you've given us quite a lot of things to try. Do you have something?
Do you know, I was thinking about this, and I think the simplest thing I would say is that it's not customary to chant in secondary schools. Mm. So I thought about, and I thought, chant with them. They actually quite like it. And even those who don't like it will do it. And the act of verbalizing vocabulary and, you know, other things is, as we know, part of making it stick. So my husband did an awful lot of work on this, on culture, and had them chanting poems together and things like this. And we drilled them to the point where, it's just normal. We just chant now. We chant at the end of lessons. Sometimes we chant at the start of lessons. We chant vocabulary. We chant poems. We chant all sorts of things. And it helps. Every little helps.
I'm an easy convert to this because it sounds very performance art based to me, and something, you know, practicing and ensemble reading and, you know, getting the words into your mouth and really taking ownership by being able to pronounce them and use them is really important, something I'm very passionate about in drama. So I'm on board with that. But if you're not on board, then maybe have a go and get your chant on.
Well, Nicola Lo Celso from Willows. I think we need to relocate our studio a few miles down the road because we're just getting all the goodies from Willows now, aren't we? It's brilliant. They're a whole school friend of the podcast. Thank you for coming in. That was really, really interesting. We enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
And we will be back with you in 2 weeks' time. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was Nicola Lo Celso from Willows High School in Cardiff. Thanks to Nicola for coming in. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lamburn and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.